What Jung is talking about here, he describes as nebulous, as appearing mystical, as depreciated by our world and misunderstood, just as, in his mind, so was the ancient alchemist Gerhard Dorn. And yet, he says, this experience is echoed in the mysteries of the Orient, in the meditations of the East, which our time has been so strangely attracted, as well as in the great spiritual events of our own Western culture. It's a mystery, this. And this is the key that in the first three lectures I tried to convey to you, you see. You don't understand Jung's map. You will not understand Jung's map. Oh, you may understand part of it. It may get you out the hedge and down the road a ways, halfway to the Great Crossing before Rivendell. It may get you halfway there. The map will guide you a part of the way. But you really won't understand the intent of the map until you understand the Ultima Thule, the last land where the dragons dwell. What is beyond that ultimate border? Because in Jung's concept, the unconscious, this objective psyche, which he called the collective unconscious, truly has no bottom, has no beginning. The bucket does not have a bottom. The cellar does not have a The experience, as Jung points out in Mysterium Conjunctionis, that he's talking about is a union between actually two opposites. A soul and a spirit. Now, we've forgotten in our world that there might be a difference between a soul and a spirit. The word soul and spirit mean the same thing to us, but 1,000 years ago, they did not, most clearly did not. The soul was a union of, shall we say, psychic and physical properties. When we think of our soul, we think of our soul with, you know, well, brown hair and blue eyes and my name and more or less my form, well, perfected, my form as I was when I was, or would have been when I was 20. You know, that's our soul. It's this perfect me. But, and this soul, of course, lives forever. But the point is that there was something else in us. It was an eternal spirit. It was from a ground before the ground of being, before this world. The stardust from which we are coagulated is mixed with a consciousness, with a light, with a spirit, with a reality that is its true mate, brother, sister, self, same self. The unio mentalis of the alchemists, the Mysterium Conjunctionis, the mystery of the conjunction of which Jung speaks, is a journey to the ultimate limits of this psychic realm, where all the personal has disappeared, and where we find something which he called the self, something seemingly divine and eternal, a wholeness seeking presence with us. He says in his remarks, it is like the Tao of the individual and the universal Tao coming together in the Taoist philosophy. It is like an enlightenment. It is a mystic experience. And it cannot be described nor shared. Just as you cannot describe the color red to an individual who is blind, you cannot explain this experience to one who has not had an inkling of its reality. And so Jung petitions us in Mysterium Conjunctionis. If we haven't had the experience, at least reserve judgment, because others have. And those individuals are the leaven of this world. Those individuals have been its wizards, have been the signal points of its transformation. Can you imagine Western culture without Christianity and a Christ figure at its beginning? What would that history have been? Our history is eddied around that myth. Call it a myth if you wish. That story, 2,000 years of our history, has wrapped itself around. Can you imagine the East without a Buddha? An India without an image of the Vedas, of that song of wisdom at its beginning? Some students of Jung have suggested that in his last years, he really only had one patient. Oh, we think of Jung as treating many patients, and indeed he did. But ultimately, he had one patient. And that patient was Western culture. That patient was the Western spiritual legacy in its broadest understanding. Jung felt that there was a stone that had been forgotten, and that stone was the cornerstone. What was that stone? You know, the rationality of late 19th century religious studies was extremely reductionistic. It is single visioned, remember, that single plane of history. The interests of 19th century religious studies, particularly in their Protestant forms, turn towards the historical Jesus. Who was this carpenter boy? And what did he teach? Obviously a good teacher. Made some big effects, he did. It became very, very concretistic. The history was history. Fact. And the effort of this religious studies was to find facts. And the facts were, of course, material, concrete facts. He was born in this city. He had a mother that was sort of like this, and maybe she was, maybe she wasn't. Who knows, but probably not. And he got killed maybe when he was 30, maybe he was 40, maybe he didn't, maybe they crucified somebody else, but the story stuck. And he had some disciples who had visions, and they had students, and as a result we have 2,000 years of Christian culture. Okay, I mean, it gets very materialistic, very, very concretistic. And that's really what religious studies was, and perhaps is in this very day. Actually, last week I read a paper written by a Unitarian professor of philosophy, I think from Case Western Reserve University, critiquing Jung and his mysticism, this very point. You know, that Jung is not rational. That this whole collective unconscious thing, this whole psyche thing, it has no rational basis. Okay? I don't argue. Not. I mean, rationally it's a little bit hard. I mean, philosophically it's a little hard to support. But there's something else here going on with you. As opposed to this pure, unidimensional rationality, which is dominant in our age, there comes what might be called phenomenology. Phenomenon. Okay, it doesn't make sense. But it happens. Okay, can't explain it. But it is experienced by human beings. It is experienced by human beings. And you know what? Human experience counts. Your experience, what you see, what you feel, what happens, what enters you, it counts. Can't explain it. Okay. Maybe that's the doorway of beginning to understand it. Maybe that's the doorway. Jung had an immense effect upon 20th, and I hope, 21st century culture. In 1933, a woman by the name of, if I remember her name, Olga Freube-Kaptjen, Madame, had a very lovely villa in Ascona, in Switzerland, on the Swiss-Italian border, by a beautiful lake. And she had a vision of a meeting place of the great thinkers of her time. And amongst those who she invited to the villa every summer for a conference was C.G. Jung. It was the vision to bring together the minds of the time into a place of dialogue. To the villa at Ascona came indeed some of the greatest souls and minds of the time. Jung became a central point in Jungian psychology, certainly a guiding, shall we say, motif for many of the discussions. And if I could characterize the central point of that motif, it was the phenomenology, the phenomenon of the soul, the experience of the human. You see, that is science, isn't it? To be empirical, to look at experience, what we experience. Maybe we can't measure it with our tools of measurement, with our scientific instruments, but maybe it's still something we experience. And out of the Yaskona conferences, they were called the Aranos. The Villa Aranos was the name of the villa, and these were the Aranos conferences that were held every summer. Individuals like Gershom Scholem, the father and great scholar of Jewish Kabbalistic studies, Jewish mysticism, what he called Jewish Gnosticism, Mircea Eliade, professor of religion at Chicago, author of a great multi-volumed History of Religions, which was a classic textbook and still remains so, I think, in many colleges. Henri Corbin, French scholar of Islamic mysticism, of Ibn Arabi, of the imaginal world. Joseph Campbell, the great modern American popularizer of mythology. And you know, actually, in the academic world, there's absolutely no nastier poison than you can drink than to be a popularizer. The worst thing you can do as an academician is give lectures to which people show up and write books that sell. Now, if you do either of those two things, you are not an academic. Well, at least not one that's going to be welcomed into any faculty meeting. And so we had conjoining at the Via Villa Aranos in Ascona these figures, these fathers, shall we say, of a new perspective upon modern religious studies. Out of this came a school which was called the History of Religions. And what was the center of this type of history of religion? The phenomenology of religion. You see, it's clear that most religious movements start with a charismatic figure and an event, a charismatic event, a very special event. From that event, whatever it be, it is something that individual experienced. There flows a force of charisma, an anointing, power, that is like that magic mirror, right? It transforms those who touch it. These disciples that touch this mirror are actually transformed in its image. And that transformation echoes. Sometimes it echoes for millennia, but it echoes. But you see, in the reductionistic, in the material usual orthodox development, what happens is you have an experience. And out of that experience there comes a myth. And associated with that myth, a variety of symbols. And these symbols and myths are then concretized into history, specific fact. It happened this way. Story, that might be fiction. Might be fictive. We want fact, right? So the story, the myth, becomes fact. And it becomes very important that the facts be clear. And so we have dogmas, teachings about what actually the myth means. What actually did happen. And from the dogma, there comes theology, rational discussions about the ethical behavior based upon the dogma, based upon the fact of this history, modern religion. But along came these scholars who said, you know, okay, yeah, sure, you do have a social, ethical history of religions. But what interests us? In fact, really the magic of this all, it's the phenomenon of what happens at the beginning. And how that same act, fact, crosses history again and again after that beginning stage. And so along came Gershom Scholem. And he became interested in what was depreciated at that time, certainly by 19th century Judaism in its effort at least intellectual assimilation in Europe, what was depreciated as a mystical superstition of Kabbalah, the oral tradition, the Gnostic oral tradition of Judaism. And Scholem went back and began to study the Kabbalists. And what he found is a history of experience. You know what the Kabbalists... The Kabbalists had a very strange way of reading the Torah, the books of the Bible, the five sacred books of Moses. You see, the Kabbalists understood that you could never understand the words of Torah, the meaning of Torah, until you actually experienced the same vision, the same experience that had the prophetic voices, the first prophetic voices. If you would wish to understand what was said about Abraham, then return to the vision. If you want to know about Enoch, have his vision. Elijah, see him. They sought to actually experientially ascend to an encounter with the divine. Now this experience, the problem with experience is it tends to rewrite the myths. Each experience tends to generate a new facet to the story. And this was the amazing thing about Kabbalah, as Gershon Scholem made quite clear. In Kabbalah, the tradition, and that's what the word Kabbalah means, the tradition was vision. The tradition wasn't a given legacy of ethical teachings. The tradition was the phenomenon of the event of vision. And the intention of the Kabbalist was actually to return to that state, that place, that encounter with an ultimate reality by walking the tree of life, the Sephirotic tree. Scholem, through his work, brought back into focus a phenomenon that anchored religious history. Henri Corbin, student of Islamic mysticism, particularly of a mystic by the name of Ibn al-Arabi, of the 13th century, a man who wrote extensively, Ibn Arabi, about what he called the imaginal world, meeting with imaginal individuals. Arabi was a visionary. He had angelic visitations. He met imaginal figures. He called them imaginal, but to him the imaginal was real. The imaginal was the threshold of prophecy. And Corbin wrote extensively about this phenomenon. Explain it rationally? No, you can't. But to the vision of Corbin, this was the centering point. Or Corbin, this was the centering point. Mircea Eliade wrote his great work on shamanism and his history of religion, continually focusing in upon the centrality of symbol. Symbol as a doorway. If you don't understand religious symbol, if you don't understand religious symbol, you want to understand religion, religious history. But the only way to understand symbol is to experience it yourself. Because symbol is a, as Joseph Campbell said, symbol is a metaphor and doorway to transcendence. Well, you can see how rational, academic scholars of religion might object, and indeed they have, and at great length in recent decades. You're expecting students, if they're to understand your phony phenomenology, to become mystics themselves. You want them to understand symbol, but you tell them the only way they can understand symbol is to experience it themselves. Well, where's rationality? And in response, actually preceding any criticism, you had these great scholars saying, if you're going to understand religion, understand that. Understand the experience. Well, these individuals, and many others, came together in this light of Jung at Uranus between 1933 and 1951. At age 76, Jung retired from his yearly pilgrimages to Uranus, but the conferences continued, and there Scholem, Corbin, Scholem, and many others, Joseph Campbell, came together and continued this discussion, a discussion which really transformed in many ways religious studies in this world. At the same time, in a less academic sense, Jungian psychology has penetrated into the consciousness of many individuals through its terminology. Symbol itself has a new meaning in light of Jung. Archetype. We've all heard the word now. We have this sense of internal images. Projection. Jung. We all know about projections. I mean, it's pop psychology and mom psychology. It's all around us. Myers-Briggs personality assessment. 4 typologies, or 16, or 32, or whatever factor you wish to divide it into. We are some combination of 4 strange letters, and is it the I first, or the P, or the J, or the N, and that defines us, right? In fact, we take these tests at our corporate employer's assessment office to decide whether we'll be good managers or better slaves. And God knows they want more slaves than managers, I'll assure you. But ultimately, Jung really bequeathed to us a vision. A counterbalance to a world caught in a unidimensional fiction that they call a fact. And a depreciation of a fact they call fiction. In the first entry to this series of discussions, I spoke of the wizard. And you'll recall that the word itself comes from an old Indo-European root, vide. The word vide gives us our word vision, to see what others do not, to see what others do not, to see beyond the threshold of the last hill, into that ultima thule, into that last world, into that world beyond where there be dragons. And by that vision, vide, we have wise. That wizard was wise, wise by what he had seen. He walked paths that others did not, and then came as vide guide. As a guide, by vision made wise, and by that wisdom, a guide to others. You know, there aren't many wizards in this world. I've kept an eye open for them, I think, from a very early age. I've sized up a few who I thought might be, and walked away a bit disappointed. But if there is anything that echoes that archetypal image of the wizard in this world, if there is one that you would look for to see perhaps what the mirror, what the true mirror might be, then I would suggest to you a study of this man, Carl Gustav Jung. He was a wise visionary guide to our age. And it indeed is my hope that in the coming generations we will return to him with a renewed understanding. Oh, be done with this darn psychology stuff, Jungian psychology, whatever, methodologies, rational recensions of his myth, dogmas, theologies of Jung. Be done with them. Look at the man. Look at what he had to say. Look at the fact that he was pointing to, which is a spark of life in you. A brother, a sister that awaits you. Union, the phenomenon of encounter with that thing will transform you. And alone, in that individual, in that single, in that isolated transformation within our own hearts and souls, is this world of ours transformed and perhaps saved from its own dark destiny? I'll give you one last notice. What I took actually is a joyful notice. I mentioned to you in the first or maybe second lecture that I had a secret about the Red Book. I received a personal letter from the executive committee of the Jung Estate, or at least I got a copy of it on the internet. But I take it as personal because... Statement. This is published on the International Association of Analytic Psychologists page. The Executive Committee of the Jung Estate has requested that the following be made public. Sounds like one of those old posters you put up around, you know, around town. You know, the town crier, hear ye, hear ye. Okay. I quote, from 1912 onwards, C.G. Jung experimented with provoking an extended series of waking fantasies in himself. He later called this the method of active imagination. Drawing from these materials, he composed a work in a literary and pictorial form, which he called The Red Book. It is by no means a diary of personal events and could best be described as a literary work of psychology. Unquote. And I would add in comment, there are lots of other things I could call it too. Quote, in 1925, he discussed this experiment in a seminar now published under the title Analytical Psychology. In 1958, he commented on this material to Anelia Yaffe, who reproduced his statements in the following form. Quoting Jung, "The years when I was pursuing my inner images were the most important in my life. In them, everything essential was decided. It all began then. The later details are only supplements and clarifications of the material that burst forth from the unconscious. And it at first swamped me. It was the prima materia for a lifetime's work." Unquote. Jung. And continue the letter from the Jung estate. After Jung's death, the Red Book and the rights to it remained the property of his heirs. In view of its historical importance for the understanding of the genesis of Jung's work, his heirs decided in May 2000 to release it for publication so that it would be first made available to the public in a definitive scholarly edition. The edition is currently underway and is being edited by Dr. Sonia Shamdasani of the Wellcome Trust Center for the History of Medicine at University College of London. The edition will locate the work historically and present its literary, philosophical, psychological, and theological background, together with indicating its interconnections with Jung's subsequent work. It is hoped that this long-anticipated prospect will enable a new approach to his work. Further information concerning the edition will be released in due course. All representations will be handled by the Nidick Linder Literary Agency in Zurich. End statement. It is hoped, they say, that this long-anticipated prospect will enable a new approach to his work. And indeed, it is a time for a new approach. And so I think we'll all have a chance perhaps to see this book before we do hit the graves, at least we exit in the next few years. And it is with great gratitude that I received this letter from a friend forwarded to me. And so, my dear friends, I bring to an end this series of four lectures on Carl Gustav Jung. I thank you for your attention, and I encourage you onward, through the hedge, away from the shire, follow the path. Thank you. And now, one other announcement I'll make just in ending. I was thinking about doing another series of Jung lectures. As I said, I really didn't have any anticipation of doing anything in the near or long-term future until Maxine kicked me in the butt. But you guys seem like really nice folks, and I really do enjoy, and I very much enjoyed talking to you. I mean, from, you know, when you sit up here and talk, you really are responding to what you see in people's eyes and what you feel coming from them. And I must say, I really felt something very interesting coming from all of you, and I appreciate your coming, and I thank you. And so I was thinking about perhaps continuing a series of lectures on Jung. There's another subject that I have found perhaps less airy-fairy and mystical, and which is the what Jung called the psychological types, or the typology. This is the part of Jung's ego psychology upon which the Myers-Briggs personality assessment is founded, was founded by a mother and daughter-in-law by the name of Meyer and Briggs, amazingly enough. And I was thinking about giving a series of four lectures on the psychological typology, and I was thinking about doing this in April, and it really depended on whether I can get a place to do it. And Maxine was going to look into whether this place... Oh, it is? Okay. So I think, assuming my work schedule works out, and I'm still working this out with the hospitals, but I will try to do was Tuesday like, would that be an okay? So I'll try to do a series of four lectures, since there are four psychological types, it sort of fits nicely, there's a symmetry there. And there are also four Tuesdays in April, I think, unless there'd be five. But anyway, so I was thinking in April that we would do that. And I'll send out an email and let you know what's up. And I'm more or less planning on that, more or less, as things go, you know. And if you do not have an email address that you've clearly and legibly written on a piece of paper and handed to us, either write it on the piece of paper back there, clearly and legibly. Believe me, I've had some trouble deciphering people's scrawled email addresses. Or alternatively, just send me an email at servant@gnosis.org. It's the email address you will find on our Gnostic Society webpage. And I'll put your email on my email list, and I will send you another email electronically by the wizardry of modern science at some point in some future. And now, if there be questions or discussions, I'll open it up. And if you have to run, feel free to do so. If you want to go get some coffee and food... Tuesday after Easter, the mystery of the conjunction, Mary, Magdalene, and Christ, yes. Yes, please. That's a rather personal question. Okay, yeah, all right. Well, look, to tell you the truth, it is a delicate balance. And it's like this, you know. The waves of our lives. And I guess there was a period when this all hit me pretty hard, maybe 20 years ago. And there was a period of considerable years in which the outer was very, very secondary to me. I went for many years without reading a newspaper or looking at a computer or doing much of anything except reading Jung and dealing with the images and being a bit of a hermit. And then life comes along. And it fractures that. And outer events, you know, social, family things come in and they shake it up. And all of a sudden, however much you would like to, you know, sit in your hermitage, there are things that require attention. We wax and wane in our attentiveness to the interior. And sometimes we get enough waning. There is such, I think, that we almost forget what we were doing, where we were going, what the experience was that was centering us, you know? We can think that we've got it all, it's sort of like, you know, it's all coming together, the rubedo's about to happen, I mean, we've come through the back black stuff, we got the white stuff, and by gosh, by golly, there it is, it's in the crucible right before us. And then, as the old alchemists warn us, that's when the laboratory blows up. There's an old saying. And I don't really know much Latin, but there are these old sayings that for some reason I memorized and actually do still remember for some reason, or at least partially remember. There's one that says, quod haec est longissima via, ergo patientia mora sunt necessaria in nuestro magisterio. Therefore, remember, it's a very, very long road. Therefore, patience and determination, continuation are necessary in our work. Because, you know, hey, we're all alchemists, and we all go through our destruidos, our tearing apart, our dark phases. And then maybe we have an inkling of the light, and we see things starting to come together in the old crucible. And it blows up. Our face is covered in black tarish goo, and we have a few splinters to pick out of our butts. And there's smoke everywhere, and the landlord's going to kick us out because, you know, they think we have a meth lab down there. And we're out. And, you know, the point is that, yes, that's the ebb and flow, isn't it, really, of life? But it's a long road. At some point, after, you know, all the glassware is shattered, you have to go out and get some more glassware and start working again. And it's only by the determined and continuous effort. Jung, there's a story that was told by an acquaintance of Jung who met him when he was about in his late 70s. And they were walking on the beach by the shore of Lake Zurich. And Jung was despondent, terribly depressed, and just mumbling, "I've failed, I've accomplished nothing, no one understands, this has just all gone to nothing, it's just all gone to nothing. What have I been doing? Why, oh why?" Here he is, 78 years old, after all of that, despondent that somehow he had failed to get it across. We all have our despondencies and we have our relationships. The world is going to interfere with us. There will be points when the interior becomes so extraordinarily powerful that it's very hard to deal with the exterior. And during those periods, sometimes the exterior sort of falls by the wayside, you know. And then there will be those periods when the exterior consumes us like a vampire. And it is a bit of a vampire. It would gladly, there are so many forces in this world that would gladly drink our blood. In fact, I see people whose blood is being drained every day. And I drain some of it now, myself, too. But I give some back now and then, too, you know. So, I don't know if that was a complete answer, but if it was an incomplete answer, it's the only one I have. The Cohen song say, there's a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in.
Flatland doesn't seem to be totally secure.
It doesn't seem to be totally secure, but you know, it has very, very strong armies and very big fortresses, and they're all over the place. The point is there is a fracture in everything. And that is how the light gets in. And there's a fracture in this unidimensional world view. And there is light coming through in various places. I'll tell you that 15 years ago, I would go to the bookstores and I'd count the books on the shelves, you know. And every time I saw the Freud section get a little bit smaller and the Jung section get a little bit larger, it's like, you know, it's coming. And then Bill Moyers and Joseph Campbell got together on PBS, and you know, lots of the people I associated with were watching the series back in the late 80s, and it seemed like, boy, something is happening. I mean, the Jung shelves are, you know, like expanding, and this mythology stuff is going. People are reading Joseph Campbell. He's on public television. Something's happening. And then I had this terrible sense of withering thereafter, sometime in the 1990s. But you see, that perspective may have been me. It may have been what was happening in me. I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm not so sure. And if, again, one sees something happening, senses something, you know, going on, perhaps it's best at this point to step back and instead of projecting it out into the world and having great expectations and hopes, letting it rest within us and understand that if the transformation is happening anywhere of import, it's happening in us. And if it is happening in us, it is happening in the world. It is, because we are it. It's like there's something synchronistic here, shall I say. It's like the medieval monks who felt that if they alone in their cell were praying, that prayer might be the salvation of the world. Or like the old Indian chief that Jung met. He was a Hopi Indian who felt that it was the prayers of his people that kept the sun rising every day. Seems strange. So I have waxed and waned in hope for this world. And in a sense, in an ultimate sense, I have absolutely no hope for this world. None. Because I am more or less scientifically certain that this place is going to end up as a cosmic cinder within 13 billion years. Yeah, and, you know, I may not be here to see it. God willing, I won't be here to see it. But, you know, ultimately, this place is going to shit. I mean, it's falling, it's crumbling. Entropy, cosmic entropy, it's going up. Okay, so, I mean, you really can't have too much hope in the world. But you can have hope in the world. You can't have hope in the world. But you, as one in the world, can have hope. And indeed, you might even be the hope. And Jung really emphasized this again and again, is that the world hangs by a very thin thread. The world, the destiny of the world hangs by a thread. And that thread is the psyche of humankind. Not just generally, but individually. Because ultimately, this work is not done collectively. Those old alchemists were always sort of in their own little alchemical lab, working away. And, you know, the image also of that alchemical stone was that if it's made, if it actually happens, everything it touches is transformed. And for image of that, I give you a Christ, a Buddha. Probably historical happenings, individuals, mirrors that reflected new images and transformed the world. And there are little ones. I mean, you know, there are grand Buddhas, and there are what a friend of mine called tadpole Buddhas. But they all have that Buddha nature, and that Buddha nature is one that, what? It enlightens. It's enlightened, yeah, okay, great. But the point is that its enlightenment touches and enlightens. Yes, please. That's right.
And, what I'm wondering is how open the field is. And I realize that you're talking to diametrically sometimes opposed psychiatry and psychology. Mm. But it seems to me that how open is the field of psychoanalysis now to somebody not necessarily carrying on the work of the input, but that would bring something totally new. Is that kind of closing? Like a lot of scientific fields are saying, we can't test it in the laboratory, and if it's not based on behavior, then we don't, you know, it doesn't modify behavior, or we don't care.
I have essentially no expectation that Jungian psychiatry, that Jungian practice in a psychoanalytic mode will find further acceptance in academic psychiatry as it exists in this day and age. None. But that may be a good thing. Who knows? Because what it does, perhaps, is puts it back into another perspective. And the problem with the whole Jungian psychoanalytic movement, at least of a part of it, of a portion of it, was this sort of pandering to scientific respectability. Well, that pandering to the by that pandering, I mean, is just a continual veiling of the fact that there is sort of a mystical core to Jung. What to me is the most obvious thing, but you sort of had to veil it, as did Jung throughout most of his life, and that's the very reason why the Red Book hasn't been published here for, you know, 50, 60 years after his death. There was a lot of resistance to veiling this. Well, now I see a bit of an unveiling. And so psychiatry today, I teach it in the University of Utah Medical Center setting, and I deal with a lot of residents, psychiatric residents. These guys have never heard a word about Jung, and they know hardly anything about Freud, which I don't mind, but Jung, really now? Really? I mean, I've sat down at 3 a.m. and we've talked sometimes, these young fellows and gals, and ladies and gentlemen, doctors and doctors, and you know, they're just, this is simply not a part of their educational experience. Ask them about, once again, dopamine and serotonin chemistry and the various agents to transform those, and they know a bit. And you know what? What they know is useful. It really is useful. And believe me, it's useful, because I deal with that too, and I see its usefulness. And I would not badmouth at all, but it is one dimension. Now, that dimension is useful. I mean, it is nice to know how to suture when you're faced with a cut. It's nice to know how to stop bleeding when you need a cork. But it's not the total solution.
And there's no way that you can see this ever brush that subject, because I think there are a lot of Van Goghs running around out there that a good shot of Thorazine and they can turn into average.
That's the artistic problem with the unconscious, is when the great artist really is a conduit for...
And that's not ever going to be normal.
Yeah, but sometimes the artist also is burned to a cinder by the fire of that creative energy and destructs, and you see that. And I have a friend who's a writer, and he suffers from depression. Sometimes very...